this is Len Testa. We're here at Disney's Animal Kingdom for another exciting podcast with Jim Hill. It's part of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish series. I got to start off by saying it's incredibly hot here today, so you'll hear me sweating and panting along the way. But without further ado, here's our good friend, Jim Hill. Jim, first, I know you want to thank your parole officer for letting you back out here. Is there anything you'd like to say to the governor?
But, you know, it's so nice that they dropped the charges.
Nobody saw me do it. You can't prove anything.
That's right.
All right, so we're here at the beginning of the Animal Kingdom at the Oasis. It's the what we call in theme park speak, Jim, the transition area into the rest of the park. And like Led Zeppelin said, Jim, there are two paths you can go by.
This is true.
In the long run, you're still on Discovery Island.
I have to tell this story. But first, turn around. Right here, there's a gentleman. Go first, he walked away. The survey taker. All right.
My guy's taking surveys at Disney? What?
Okay.
What?
My Disney's Animal Kingdom story, first one, starts with a survey taker.
Is it real?
It's 1993. Okay.
Right, everyone do the flashback there.
Okay. I am walking into the Magic Kingdom, and here is a survey taker. And again, everyone else on the planet, person with a clipboard, they've got leprosy. It's like, I have learned, particularly at Disney, you walk up to them. And in this case, I walked up and said, hi, what are you doing? He said, well, we're surveying for a potential fourth theme park. And I was like, really?
Really? No, you say. Did you stroke your beard like it? fourth park, you say.
And it's like, they literally take us into the Walt Disney story.
And over on Main Street where the exposition hall
and
was.
Now we sit down to the theater. It's myself, Jeff Lang, and my then-wife, Michelle Smith. And we proceed to watch the concept film for what was known then as Disney's Wild Animal Kingdom. And they literally, it's all of this amazing concept art. Now, of course, me being the weasel that I am, they've handed me a survey with a pencil that I'm supposed to be filling out.
You're taking notes.
You're
doing sketches.
You know, and of course, at the end,
I'm going to need another one of these.
Well, no, it gets better. It's over. It's like, I have brain full. You know? But it's like, I didn't take any, damn it. It's like, and so conversations. Then the people go, well, you know, we're doing surveys here today, and tomorrow we're doing over at Disney MGM. Like, really?
All right. Approximately what time would you be staffing this particular endeavor?
So that's the thing. So Jeff and Michelle and I then go, and we literally sit at a table and do a brain dump. Like, okay, we saw this. And literally the next day, Jeff and I are over in MGM.
What a coincidence.
But we're walking around, head swiveling. Like, somewhere here there will be a person with a clipboard. And sure enough, a little plaid shirt suddenly, you know, standing at the corner. And so we walk in. Oh, this time we're prepared. All right, Jeff has his video camera.
This is the big shoulder-mounted one back in the day, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But what Jeff does is he puts his camera back on the floor and hits record. So we don't get pictures, but we get full audio. All right, so now we have the full concept, the full information. But of course, this is back in the Gutenberg days. There was no internet. I mean, you had to literally go from Hutter House out.
You said Gutenberg like the Bible, not Steve.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right.
As I understand,
how does Police Academy have anything to do with the story, Jim?
I understand that he's going door to door now as well. So that could well be. So anyway, jump ahead. It's March 18th, 1994, the day my daughter is born.
Yeah.
And I'm literally sitting in Arnold Palmer Hospital in downtown Orlando, and just this wonderful day, and I'm filled with benevolence, you know, and it's happy spirits. And I open the Orlando Sentinel, and they have a cover story about the fourth theme park. And it's like, and the thing is that clearly somebody talked to them but didn't have all of the information. But it's Leslie Doolittle, who used to be the tourism reporter for Orlando.
Right.
And it's like, I figure, I'm happy, I've had a child, I pick up the phone that's there in the room.
Leslie, guess what we have?
You know, and that was the thing. Literally a day and a half later, I'm in the offices of the Sentinel, and it's like, in fact, where this gets interesting is one of the people I dealt with that day was Craig DeZern, who's now the head of PR. But yes.
He went from the Sentinel to Disney.
That's exactly. I'm in a room with Craig DeZern and Leslie Doolittle. It's like, well, here's it's everything. It's the transcript the next day.
Yeah, that's probably an awkward thing when he works for Disney.
Well, that could well be. But, we were intimate with this park. In fact, one of my favorite photos, in fact, we ended up in Disney Magazine. During the construction phase, from the tree farm, the road all the way through to 182 was open. So one day, Michelle, Alex, and I, along with our friend David Schiller, drive through the construction site, and it's like literally at this point, all they had were giant plywood signs up saying like, one, this is where the Tree of Life was going to go, two, this is where Asia, and so we are the first family. Because we have a picture of us standing next to the one. All right, there was no tree, but this spot, we were first in this park.
You can put a time capsule there. That would
be
funny.
That's exactly. Yeah. So I want Disney to recognize that
you're
at some
first,
point.
The first visitor to the animal. Right. How did you get onto the construction site? Did you like play lost tourist?
Well, you know, there. It's you know.
We're Canadian.
What is the phrase? It's better to ask forgiveness.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like, you know, or beg forgiveness.
Tom said, not entirely unknown here at the Universal Guide.
Anyway, all right. So back to here at the Oasis.
So it's the Oasis. So it's different than any transition that you've got in any other theme park. It's there's no Main Street, right? That's the big thing, right? And so the studios you've got a Sunset Boulevard or Hollywood Boulevard at Magic Kingdom. You've got Main Street, Epcot. You've got sort of the Future World Plaza.
And here's the problem, though, that because the people here at Walt Disney World have spent the work being the week being trained by those.
Right.
This facility confuses them. All right. And in fact, you know, and in fact, to be honest, when you're here in the morning where people are going, the safari is open, run to the back, you know, they lose out on, this is supposed to, according to Joe Rohde, this is the area that's supposed to teach you that as you go through Animal Kingdom, you're supposed to move slowly. You're supposed to take in your environment. Notice that, you know, there are small animal enclosures off to the side. It teaches you the vocabulary for the rest of this theme park.
It does, actually. I mean, if you walk slow enough, you totally get it. I mean, the fact that there's a tree canopy, right? There's no tree canopy anywhere else.
Yeah.
And if you, to your point, I mean, if you go left and right, if you look left and right, you can definitely see that there are animals in both places.
But I think, in fact, in hindsight, in fact, a lot of Imagineers have talked about, as a standalone attraction, this would be so much more successful. But when people come down here and stay in Disney hotels and go to the other parks, that's the vocabulary they bring in.
The thing that's
and it's
different,
like,
yeah.
I must march to the first thing. You know, of course, and not that anybody would be suggesting a way they could move to the park quickly.
No, I don't know how that would ever happen.
I don't know.
The technology simply can't exist for that.
So, but no, Rohde worked hard. I mean, they worked on the entrance for this thing, multiple iterations. In fact,
I mean, it's beautiful. You know, the thing that amazes me about the entrance is, so they've mixed trees, but notice how much bamboo is here.
Yep.
And the bamboo is here because it grows like weeds, right?
Yep.
I mean, essentially, it's a hard weed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really nice when storms kind of roll in to the Animal Kingdom. You hear the bamboo clinking together. It's a nice effect, actually.
Well, the other thing, frankly, I don't think they took into account when they were building this park is that the canopy that they've created, as beautiful it is, does hold the heat, does hold the humidity. And
a little bit, yeah. It's hot as hell in here today.
Yeah, but it, again, just a wonderful area, beautiful design, but in a lot of ways confusing for a lot of guests. And again, we're going to be dealing with the confusion issue a lot in this theme park.
particular park?
So.
Should we walk to the right?
Sure.
So we have two paths, so we're going to go to the right. As we're walking, a white stork is walking across our path. It's amazing how realistic and lifelike they make those things. It's really nice. Now, you mentioned though that if the Oasis was its own attraction, it would be much more successful. I think that's true with the trails over on Discovery Island behind Tree of Life. Those are amazing.
They are.
They're beautiful, and no one sees them.
No, absolutely. But that again, this is the problem with this park. They in a lot of ways. They did their job too well. It's so
unstructured that people don't know what to do, and they miss out on some of the more beautiful things.
And look, a survey guy.
A survey guy. What?
Okay, never mind. It's gonna be good.
Jim's distracted.
15 bar. 15. He could be the guy.
Squirrel.
All right. Anyway, no, it's because people, you know, it just. They're looking to bring their Disney visual vocabulary in. It's like, okay, that's right. The entrance, and I exit through the gift shop. And this is not that park. This is the park where it's like, well, what's over here? Well, what's over there? And, you know, have a strolling, unstructured day.
Right.
On top of, you know, big attractions that drive you deep into the park. So
that's it. That's the, other than the Tree of Life, there really is no weenie. Here's an architectural element I wanted to call out. So we're walking underneath a small rock bridge, and if Sam Genoway were here, Sam Genoway, our urban design guy, if Sam were here, Sam would say that the purpose of the two rock structures that we're going through are served to constrain your view so that as you get through the second one, everything opens up like a huge panorama. This is actually a visual trick you see in lots of theme parks. You actually see it on roller coasters, too.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And on California Screaming in Disneyland, they do the same thing with the canopy.
Mm-hmm.
So as you go up, you're under the canopy, and then as you reach the top, the canopy ends and you see nothing but blue sky. It's an amazing effect. So we're past that now.
No, it's a great storytelling effect. And again, you know, the notion here that you've come through the Oasis and you're about to get your big reveal of the Tree of
Life. It's the big reveal. Mm-hmm. This is the other thing I think is interesting. On the way out of the Oasis, you can actually walk through a path that doesn't lead you back to the entrance. It's a circle. that part in and of itself is moderately surprising. The fact that there's not a cart at either end of it.
Well,
I think it's the more surprising thing.
You know, I'll give them that. There's a certain level of purity to this park. It's like we don't entirely pick up you up by the ankles and shake you, but oh god, if they could.
Well, we're walking over the bridge on what's the name of this river?
Discovery River.
Discovery River and Discovery Island. Oh, that makes sense.
Yes.
Almost like they thought of it that way.
You know.
So we're walking onto Discovery Island. We see the Tree of Life off in the distance. We're gonna go counter anti-clockwise.
Okay.
As they say. Because the Coriolis effect is strong with us. Yeah.
Yes, we are north of the...
We're north of the equator, so we're going to... Yeah, exactly.
All right. Tree of Life.
So, actually, we're coming up with the Discovery Island character landing. This is the aborted boat ride, right?
Oh, yes. So, yes. Yeah. You know, so many... You know, again, so many opening year attractions that never quite worked out.
It was a boat ride that just went around the island, right?
Well, it...
Slowly.
It was supposed to introduce you to the world. In fact, you know, between introducing you to, you know, they had the wonderful Iguanodon AA figure down by the river,
right.
And they were supposed to have the dragon that was going to come out of the cave and breathe fire at you, and you were supposed to, you know, have your boat bumped by a horrible, horrible sea monster that the guide was actually going to have to play a lyre to put back to sleep. I mean, there were all these...
A liar, like a small harp.
There we go.
A liar, right?
That's like, I swear I'm not a liar. Anyway. No, I mean, it was a park that... It's strange. This park turned out to be so much more expensive than Disney ever anticipated. And what's frustrating is that so much of the money, at least for the opening year, went back to the back of the house. Because, you know, you don't like the elephants to get out. You know?
It's problematic, yeah.
Yes, and, you know, when the lions eat the tourists, that's a bad thing.
It's gonna drop revenue, I think. If not in the short term, in the long term.
But with so much money spent on back of the house issues with elephant barns and, you know, enclosures where you can, you know, medicate, you know, your giant cats and that sort of thing. It meant that when the park opened, they had to cut corners. And one of the places they did it was Discovery, you know, Riverboat Ride. And tourists were furious because they'd stand in line for 45 minutes and they'd get on a boat and they'd frantically be whipping their heads from side to side.
Are we missing something?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, where is the thing that we're supposed to be seeing? And it's like, well, there is no thing. So
it's just a boat ride.
Yeah.
So we're at the end of the sort of the retail area on Discovery Island. We've come to a junction now where we're... to our left is the entrance to It's Tough to Be a Bug. To the right is Dinoland USA. I actually like the retail area here quite a bit. It's unassuming.
No.
It's, and they've got some really cranking AC, which I think are really the two things I look for in a
absolutely.
Disney.
But at the same time, the wood carving, they actually bought in, you know, the upwards of 60 wood carvers who all they did were create these wonderful art pieces that are used to decorate the columns and that sort of thing.
So I heard something interesting, and I don't know if it's true. We'll walk to the park and we'll see if it is. That the carvings on the retail establishments are all herbivores, and the carvings on the restaurants are carnivores.
I heard that.
It's that kind of detail that I love. We'll walk over to Flame Tree and see if it's true.
I'm looking at an owl. We could be there.
That's right.
But anyway, just off to our left here is...
It's Tough to Be a Bug.
And...
Here's the thing. What do you do for... So eventually when It's Tough to Be a Bug ends its run, what are you going to put in there? You're not going to go Space Invaders.
No. You know,
and
what's interesting is that there were two iterations of the show ahead of that. There was literally a Mother Nature show where literally a willowy blonde was going to tell you about, you know, in fact, they had started using a little bit of the artwork from Fantasia 2000, from the Firebird Suite.
Fantasia 2000 being a movie no one saw about music no one listens to.
Well, there you go.
Go ahead.
Okay. I remember there were five of us in the theater. So. Anyway, yeah, I'm looking at herbivores. Okay.
So on Flame Tree, there's an alligator, an owl, or a crocodile, an owl. It's definitely all carnivores.
That's scary. Okay. Next, they were working on a Lion King show, and it was Rafiki talking to Simba and Nala.
Oh, that would make sense.
And
so that's like around Lion King 12. Is that when that's going to?
But this is where it got interesting. Is that anybody who worked with Michael Eisner back in the day always feared the meeting where things would change, because Michael had the attention span of a hummingbird. All right, and just sort of, you know, he'd come into work and he would have seen something, and it's like, you know, hey, we should do horses, you know, and
they're going to be big.
And Michael evidently came from, you know, and they were literally, they had boarded, they were beginning work on the Lion King version. I think Robert Guillaume actually had already come in, recorded a temporary track, and, you know, Michael's like looking at early, you know, rough stuff on It's a Bug's Life, and it's like, bugs live in trees? We should do that.
We should do bugs.
And it's like, really? Okay.
All right.
Because now the guys from Pixar, it's like, we understand we're still making the movie, and we don't have the people to spare to make your movie. So that's the...
You want us to make a movie while we're making your movie.
That's right.
Okay.
So they actually...
What could possibly go wrong with that?
They farmed it out to Rhythm and Hughes.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but anyway, now...
Now we're entering Dino Land. And the interesting thing about Dino Land is, again, there are two paths, right? You can go off to the left to Theater in the Wild, and then you can go off to the right and go underneath the Sioux, the giant that... Mm-hmm. No, sorry, this is the Brontosaurus. Mm-hmm. Sioux is in Dinosaur. But it's you're going underneath the bridge. You got the Boneyard on your left. You've got retail or restaurants on your right. But again, so you see this repetition of a pattern where to get where you want to go in a land, you could go two ways.
Yep.
And again, coming up here, right? So once we've gone past that fork in the road, we come to another fork in the road. You can go left to Dinorama. You could go right to Dinosaur. We'll go right to Dinosaur.
Okay. And again, this is another park that, from what, I can tell you, in fact, it'd be fun to put in the show notes. Let me see if I can chase down the actual transcript of the original presentation to the park.
Oh, that'd be hysterical.
You know.
Let's take a look. Is there a giant crocodile here still?
Let's see.
No, he must be on vacation. Usually this pool is filled with crocs.
No,
okay. Oh, no, there he is. He's underneath the shade. He's hot as well. They are cold-blooded.
Okay. Anyway, this is...
We're passing Dino Bite Snacks. We've got Restaurantosaurus.
They worked so hard on the theming for this. I mean, the whole notion...
Restaurantosaurus is actually really well-themed. It's the layout inside is a little confusing.
Yep. No, it's you're supposed to get the sense that this... was a dinosaur dig that just sort of built out. And again, you know, when you look at, for example, the detailing up here, these are supposedly where the people who were working on the dig at, you know, during the day, this is where they hang out at night. And you can see, like, their cocaine pyramid and all that.
So we're looking at Restaurantosaurus, and on the roof of Restaurantosaurus are a couple of lawn chairs with a small cooler that is suspended. So it looks like two kids from college have put seats on the roof of their building to look out over the park. It's actually a good effect. Is it an Airstream trailer as well?
That's it, exactly.
Nice.
But again, the component that's missing here, in fact, the very thing you were supposed to see when you pulled into the parking lot to the back of Dinoland USA was going to be the excavator. It was this. You know, the idea is that...
The excavator.
Literally, it's a roller coaster. The gimmick is that the backstory on this is that this was a sand and rock quarry. They had been digging. They discovered the a giant fossil.
Oh, so there's a backstory.
Right.
Okay, got it.
So they had to stop, you know, and so this is what compelled the archaeologists to come here and work. So it's a dig site in the site of, like, a giant sand pit that already has all of this, you know, heavy-duty track work and all that. And it's an old-fashioned wooden roller coaster.
That actually makes sense as a story.
Yeah.
You can actually fit a Dinorama into that, too, if it's a giant construction site for a road.
It
could actually work together. Actually, that's kind of funny, because then Dinorama would sort of kind of make sense, because whereas now it's just bad.
Well, see, it just came down to the fact that they were looking at, they could spend... $120 million.
We've got a great $120 million project for you. You got 15 and a half.
Well, actually, you know, that's the interesting thing about... boy.
We're walking by a dinosaur right now. We're at the T-Rex Sioux statue.
But you ended up, at least in that case, it was like you could spend $120 million on one ride, or for $120 million you could have multiple rides and expand Dinorama. And that's what they did. Yeah. It was more a thought about capacity.
Yeah, so they spent the money on capacity rather than on the one good ride. That's it. No. But they're doing the exact opposite. They went the exact opposite way that Universal did with Potter. Potter went with one really good ride, one mediocre ride, and
it made all the difference. Now, yeah. In the case of Dinosaur,
well, the thing is, it's a question of we don't have enough money to do it right, but we have enough money to do it over later. Yeah. That's the that was what they were betting. So we're up at Dinosaur now, Matt Hochberg's favorite ride. And the thing that I love most about Dinosaur is Felicia Rashad from the 80s. In the if you ever want to know what the Cosby Show looked like, all you have to do is come back here. You don't have to go watch TBS. For me, it cuts down on my cable bill.
All right. And again, I can tell you this because, again, I have the transcript. I saw the art. This wasn't the ride we were supposed to have.
The what? I'm shocked. Shocked, Jim Hill.
The ride we were supposed to have was this ingenious marriage of the Star Tours
simulator.
Yeah. And but it had a movement component. In fact, you were supposed to be in a vehicle, a tracked vehicle, like a bulldozer. Mm-hmm. And again, you were sent into this environment 60 seconds before. You were supposed to retrieve a specimen. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a question of, we're just going to go back. And it was going to be like the Jungle Cruise, as in you would turn corners and it wouldn't be a question of it's dark out. It's like it's in that moment before the sun goes down. So it's full twilight scenes. And they had, for example, the that wonderful moment in the Jungle Cruise, we turn and it's the Veld and you have all of those things.
Right.
They did that with dinosaurs. In fact,
like a sweeping panoramic?
And you're looking out at, 30, 40, 50 different species interacting. And again, they took this idea from the art, from the actual dinosaur movie. And in fact, one of my favorite pieces out of my Disneyana collection is a friend who worked on this. When they pulled the sequence out of the movie, one day a box shows up at the house, and it's this beautifully sculpted log with this beautifully little sculpted dinosaur with a tiny little fern on it. He literally pulled it out of the 1-inch to 1-foot model of the attraction. It's like, I want this to go to somebody who will appreciate it, as opposed to when I throw everything out in the dumpster. But again, it was just one of these things where, as the back of the house began consuming, what they had to. And again, realistically, you cannot shortchange, animal, keeping the public away from animals, keeping the animals away from the public.
They had a choice, right? It's substandard animal enclosures, or cutting budgets on animal enclosures, or cutting budgets on rides.
So that's
people wouldn't tolerate the animal abuse stuff. I mean, you could tolerate Dinorama a lot more than you could tolerate ill-treated elephants.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah, so it kind of makes sense.
The borders of this just crept in, and it just then became, okay, it's at night. Okay, now it's at night. Now that's it's right. Dark
to save on lighting. Yeah, exactly.
So
the other thing I like about Dinosaur is you notice the plant changes to ferns, because ferns are supposed to be more representative of the Cretaceous period.
Yeah.
So again, they've kind of hit that.
They're trying. That's what I enjoy about Disney, the notion that they will in fact revisit an attraction and try to tweak. In this case, I don't think a planter counts as a tweak.
Well, the thing that I don't understand about the planter is, I mean, normally water is used to convey dynamism, right? To make things dynamic as it's walking. But then, so they've got this water feature, right? Smack dab in the middle of the entrance to the park or to the attraction. But then they cover it with ferns that are 6 feet tall, so no one can see it. I don't know where they're going with that. Let's go this way. Let's go. We'll walk this way through Dino.
Okay.
So this is one of my favorite paths, actually, through the Animal Kingdom. It's one of the things I like about the park. We talked about multiple ways to get through places. The exit to Dinosaur is actually a very nice walking path over to Dinorama. Have you been this way?
It's been a while.
To quote Bill Murray, I'm sure there are lots of ways I've gone that you haven't, ma'am. Stripes, the greatest movie of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the beginning of that movie.
Army training.
All right, we're walking out of the retail area. We're walking back towards the exit to Dinosaur. Again, it's shaded. This is sort of like a contemporary Cretaceous, so it's kind of like a Tomorrowland meets sandstone, really. But it's an interesting sort of place. It's not bad. I like the way they executed it. It's the chunky sort of triangular and square shaped rocks. They've got water fountains. And again, notice the more ferns here, and actually less bamboo than in other places.
No, it definitely nails home the idea. But anyway, back in the day when this first opened, the whole notion of... I'm blanking the name of the couple. The...
Laverne, Shirley.
No.
Chester and Hester.
Chester and Hester. The idea is that Chester and Hester, this was opportunistic. They had found out about the dinosaur dig. So they took their establishment, which was at the edge of the dig, and just tried to turn it into a tourist trap. And
is that the backstory?
Yeah.
You summarized in two sentences something I actually never understood. That's beautiful.
All right. But then to decide, okay, well, they really went nuts and built a carnival. Okay.
You know. All right, if you say so.
Yeah.
It's not what Stuckey's would have done, Jim.
No, that's tasteful, kind people.
well, I was thinking more about the lack of pecan log rolls, but your thing works too. How about taste?
So,
All right, so we're walking through the Chester and Hester retail area right now. A little bit crowded, but the bonus here is the air conditioning, I think.
Yes.
We'll walk straight up.
This is a park where you really value the air conditioning opportunity.
All right, so we're walking through lots of dinosaur models, lots of retail stuff, and a little bit of noise from the kids. So we come out of the retail, and we immediately see the sign for Chester and Hester's Dinorama. We've got Primeval Whirl to your right. We've got Triceratops Spin to your left, and a giant yellow dinosaur straight ahead of us.
And as somebody who actually, the number of times I drove back and forth to Florida and didn't stop at south of the border and long to.
All right. What am I missing?
Exactly.
Single time.
You know, and when I finally stopped and actually went to the top of the Sombrero, it was greatly disappointing.
But you've done it now. It's like you checked it off the box, right?
But this is that. I mean, they've done a wonderful job. But it's like, you know, it's kind of funny. That's Frank Oz. Disney actually had a meeting with Frank Oz about having him actually come back and direct the new Muppet movie. But at this point, the movie they were doing was the cheapest Muppet movie ever made. And
right.
The gimmick was that Gonzo had spent all the money on the credit sequence. So they they had to shoot the film guerrilla style. And Frank, who hadn't actually been working with the Muppets since like 90, 91, loved this idea. And so he said, give me the script, go home. And so he has this meeting with Dick Cook. And he comes in the door and he says, okay, all right, to shoot this movie, I think we're going to need to spend like $30 million. And Dick Cook kind of blanches and it's like, well, we were thinking more like 10 or 15. And he says, do you realize how much money you have to spend to make something look cheap? And that's actually, I tell that story for here.
That's the theme of this.
You know, I mean, this is $120 million worth of ride shows and attractions that, you know, you have to, in fact, we're about to walk by the orange dinosaur that, because it's not a Florida-friendly color, you know, you have to spend all of this time, you know, painting just to maintain. So a faded, you know, actually works for a road.
It's a faded yellow. It's a, you know, if Ralph Lauren actually could come up with that color for walls, he'd be richer than he is now. I think that's amazing. So the background noise you hear is kids playing whack-a-mole. But it's whack-a-pachycephalosaura. I don't know. I wasn't good at spelling. And Primeval World's open right now. That's good. Are they running one side or two? Looks like one side.
Yeah.
Are they going to keep Primeval World running? Not to make light of, you know, what was a tragic situation, you got to figure, you're working in Animal Kingdom, right? You walk in on a Tuesday, you punch your time card, they give you your assignment for the day. It says Primeval World. That's a message from management, isn't it, Jim?
Right now, it's literally in the hand of the magic eight ball that the Disney lawyers have that... You know, they've let it reopen, but they are really not happy.
Well, I heard literally as early as the weekend before it opened, there were cast members that were working there who were told it may never open again. It kind of reopened on a Monday.
Yep.
I think because Disney had actually told the Sentinel that it had opened the previous Friday and it didn't.
Yep.
But as of that weekend, there were cast members being told, I don't know if it was officially or unofficially, but that it would never open again.
There's, you know, it's still out, you know, and again, that's another thing that's fascinating about Disney.
Well,
that
it's an off-the-shelf ride, though. That's the thing I can't figure out. So what makes it? And the cast members were actually in an unauthorized area, right?
They were, but The concern is, one, it happens once, it's an accident. Yeah, it happens twice.
Twice is bad design. Yeah.
So it's like, all right, and can we fix this?
Yeah.
And the reality is, for what we'd spend to fix it, we could put it into attraction that wouldn't kill people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we are right now. So
that's interesting. So we're walking, we've left that part, we've left the Dinorama part of Dinoland. We're coming up on the Finding Nemo show building, which, by the way, is huge.
Yep. Mother is.
But again, and it's extremely popular, right? I mean,
it continues on. In fact, I was.
And a steel band, a steel drum band. I love a steel drum band. I do.
Yeah, this one is here for a while. Bobby Lopez and his wife, Kirsten Anderson, did the score and did a wonderful job.
We're talking now about Nemo, right?
Yep. And, but do you remember the first show in here? Did you see that?
Tarzan?
No, Jungle Book.
No, I missed Jungle Book, no.
Oh, it was Disney Jungle Book meets Cirque du Soleil.
Really?
They had a stage that was made out of a trampoline.
Like a Festival of the Lion King does.
Yep. But what was cool about it was that they had, you know, people in Jungle Book costumes that had been designed specifically for the show that had lots of yarn and fake fur, and they'd throw themselves on the trampoline and they'd leap out. So it was like this really active show that was very entertaining for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Went on for 45, but you know. Just...
That's my whole thing my thing with Cirque du Soleil. It's fabulously talented, very bendy people jumping around. I can take that for maybe 5 minutes, the length of one music video. And then after that, it's like just different ways that you can contort yourself. I get it. You're flexible. You probably make some people very, very happy. It's just not for me.
Well, good night, everybody.
How do you talk that? So we're walking past Nemo. Nemo's actually... The other interesting thing I think about the Nemo show is that it bucks the trend that you see in Disney shows being 7.5 minutes long.
No,
this thing's a good half an hour, right?
Absolutely. Actually, closer to 45.
45, that's right. Yeah, when you talk about that.
Yeah. And
and it works. I mean, people like it. They'll line up out the door.
Actually, it works so well. Disney Theatrical has been by here a couple times to kick the tires. That, you know, just it's like...
Finding Nemo, taking on the road?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things where it's like, it's solid. You know, in fact, everyone just sort of like, you musicalize that and it works.
What?
So... You know, it just, but in the end, it's just sort of like, how do you take something out of a theme park and put it in a theater? The belief now is that at some point they will close down the show, wait a few years, and then expand it out to a full-blown theater piece. So,
really?
So.
Well, the good news is, and they've got the properties, they can go out and essentially musicalize pretty much anything. They've got a lot of stuff to work with, and the theater space is huge.
Yeah.
So we're crossing over the bridge now from Dinoland into Asia, and in the background you can hear the screams of tourists who are getting their bills for their t-shirt. No, it's Expedition Everest.
Yep.
In the background, and again, notice the plants have changed.
Yep.
Right. We've got the prayer flags up. We've got strung from trees, but you notice there's very little, if any. I can't see any bamboo actually. And lack of ferns as well.
No, horticulturally, this is an incredibly sophisticated theme park. You know, but again, that kind of brings us to the interesting thing about Expedition Everest. It's like, you know, this is an attraction right now that is running without the Yeti working.
The Yeti's broken down more than, well, Paris Hilton, but... it's amazing. And the thing never works. And so they've tried different effects, right? They've tried strobe lights on it to make it look like it's moving. They've tried darkening the. They've tried every trick that you would do if you're trying to get your ugly sister a date, right? You dim the lights. You try different sort of settings. Everything but a double scotch, I think. And they've tried giving to guests to make it look more realistic.
Sorry, I'm still kind of fixating on my sister being the Yeti.
Jim's off in a got a faraway look about
it. Sorry, it would explain the hairy lip. But here's the thing with this major broken effect, which was the driver. I mean, if you remember the initial publicity.
The initial publicity was like, oh my god, it's the most advanced Yeti we've ever had. It's amazing. It's amazing. You see it for 2 seconds, and now it's even broken.
But now, I mean, look at we are looking at this. You know, it's what a fast pass return time at 2 o'clock. You know, it's what one something like that.
Yeah.
This is not impacting.
No, it's not. I mean, people are still going on the ride. The Yeti, actually, for all its buildup, the Yeti wasn't the major draw for this attraction. It really is the fact that it's the park's only roller coaster.
And that, sadly, is the takeaway to Disney management. It's like, look, it hasn't impacted attendance. Why should I fix something that literally, you know...
I could spend the money and get exactly the same result as if I did nothing.
No, that's exactly. So that's where we are right now. And I know for all of the noise about the Disco Yeti and, you know, that they...
Nobody cares.
I mean, nobody...
It's the guests aren't voting with their pocketbooks or their feet.
And that's...
Or maybe they are, actually. They're just voting the way that some people don't like. But yeah, it's true. I mean... Though, to me, I'll still go on it, and the effect doesn't really... I mean, and I like to complain about it that it doesn't work, but in the end, it's 6-1, half a dozen of that doesn't really matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the flip side of this, though, is that because... The one thing that the Expedition Everest didn't do, and they now realize it was a mistake of placement, is that this was supposed to help this park. I mean, if we've got restaurant complexes, we've got everything. But this was supposed to help this park bump out its operating hours to 7, 8, you know, 9 o'clock at night.
Every night?
That was initially the hope and the plan. And, you know, they saw the attendance jump. I mean, don't get me wrong.
It went up a couple percent when they opened Everest. And they do have the Yak and Yeti sit-down, which, as far as sit-downs go, generally speaking, not bad.
Okay. But the hard reality is because it's so deep into the park, they can't keep it open until 8. This isn't enough to keep... You know, to make this into a real full day, or rather, a day and night park. So,
right.
You know, today, when we're in here recording, this park closes hard at 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, when you think about it at Epcot, they're just...
5 o'clock is the beginning of the second phase of Epcot, right.
It's exactly.
Yeah, Epcot actually has 2 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, Epcot's got its Future World Day, and then it's got its World Showcase Day.
Yeah, so, which we'll touch on as we get to Avatar. That's one of the reasons...
Avatar what?
You know, we get back to that side of the park, we'll talk about that.
All right. We're walking past the drink carts. By the way, I love the decor of the drink carts. Really really well decorated.
Now, Rhodey insisted. They came back with so much visual reference, and it all paid off. This you know, in fact, I remember walking through here before Everest was even open.
Right.
And it was so beautifully detailed, so, you know, so inhabited that world. It's like, this is going to be great.
They've got the different lighting effects. The thing that they've done here is they've established a ceiling in Asia that you rarely see in other areas. So, like, when we talk about ceiling, there's things above your head that aren't typically found in other lands in the park. So we start off with the prayer flags back when you cross the bridge coming from Dinoland, and then you in this part of the park, you've got small light bulbs, exposed light bulbs, and then farther on you've got more formal light bulbs, and then you've got different kinds of lighting, and then you've got even farther beyond, we can see sort of the monkey cages.
But at the same time, I mean, see, they anticipated that they'd have a nighttime.
The fact that there are lights means they anticipated that, yeah. Because it's not dark at 5 o'clock in September in
but
Florida.
That's it exactly. You spent this on theming you can't use.
Yeah.
But again,
the only times I'm really here at night is when it's dark is during Christmas, when it gets dark at 5 o'clock anyway, and the park's open for evening extra magic hours.
Okay.
Not that it's open for evening extra magic hours anymore, but, you know, you get the idea.
Well, but, you know, that is the hard reality of basing a theme park on animals, that when they're getting up at dawn and the sun's going down and they go sleepy by, you know, it's just like, okay, the entire back half of the park, you don't get to see anything.
And apparently you can't drug the animals to get them to perform on a regular 8 to 5 schedule. Huh.
Come here, Simba, have your espresso. They're out.
Okay. So we're looking at the monkey cages now. They're actually monkeys out and active. Oh, and he's moving. Well, those things move pretty fast. That's the first time I've actually seen a monkey do that. It's he's swinging from bamboo pole to bamboo pole, almost like you see in the Tarzan movies. It's amazing how realistic the monkey has learned Tarzan's moves.
Well, you know, it's all those years it studied at Juilliard.
That's where that tuition went. It's fascinating. The other thing I think that's amazing here is we've essentially walked from the exit to Everest all the way through to the path where we turn right to go to Kali River Rapids. And there's a remarkable lack of merchandise. They could have merched the heck out of this whole thing, and they didn't.
Well,
the problem is on the left hand side of the path you've got the river, mm-hmm. and on the right hand side you've got animal habitat. So they were kind of constrained by that, but I think that's more of a good thing.
Well, the other thing, in fact, if you look down, which again makes it counterintuitive because you're flying monkeys through the air, but you've got all of these ground treatments where the idea is you're supposed to get the sense of this is real. I mean, you've got tracks of motorbikes, you've got, you know,
right.
animal tracks, that sort of thing. And one of the things that the retail people came through, you know, when Joe was explaining this thing to, it's like, look, you know, if people trip and fall on your wonderful themed pavement, you know, because they've turned their head and looked at a merchandise rack, you're going to sue our ass. So, you're going to have to pull back a little bit.
Exactly. So you're not going to put racks and racks of merch out. All right, let's walk down towards Collier River Rapids. So again, it's late September. It's literally like September 30th. We're recording this. It's about 92 or 93 degrees in Orlando. The merchandise that is out tend to be those spray bottle fans that are battery operated and flip flops. So if you guys are listening to this, it's November and it's December. It's cold and rainy where you're at. Just keep in mind that it's hot as hell here right now. And Jim and I are walking around a theme park in shorts. So hopefully that'll get you through the long winter. All right, we're coming up on Collier River Rapids here, which I actually like this quite a bit, except for the gratuitous water treatment at the end. Let's walk over towards the entrance.
Okay. And again.
And they're not running Fast Pass today, which is odd because it's 92 degrees.
Well.
They're covering the Fast Pass, so it must have just ended distribution.
Well, where this is... What I love about this attraction, and again, this comes off of having seen the original presentation, is that... You were supposed to, the conservation message, obviously, in this thing between the, you know, they've torn up the forest and we're going through the rapids because, you know, a bad man tearing up land and all that. But we missed the real payoff. The real payoff was you were supposed to be in your raft and actually float through the tiger enclosure.
Really? Oh, yeah. through the Maharaja jungle trail.
Yeah.
Ah.
But it was one of these things where the Imagineers presented it to the large cat people, and it's like, you understand that tigers like water?
we hadn't realized that. Too many years of watching cartoons had skewed our vision of what tigers could do.
So it wasn't one of these issues where it's like, oh, well, the water will prevent the tiger
from... Oh, the water will be a fine barrier between the tigers and the guests.
So, sadly, that story element had to go by the wayside. And so now
they couldn't find hydrophobic tigers.
They
don't work for scale. That's the problem.
You know,
it's kind of funny that you mentioned that because we're standing at the bridge, which is to the left of the entrance to Collie, and by God, it's wide enough for a raft. Yeah. This is it would have gone right past where we're at. So if you guys are listening to this at home, to the left of the entrance to Collie River Rapids is a temple again with bamboo around it, I guess for monkeys to swing. But if you look at it, there's a sort of a horseshoe shaped water path around it, and to Jim's point, it's exactly wide enough to fit one of the Collie River Rapids rafts. It would have really gone right through the Maharaja jungle trek. This is amazing.
And again, you know, the giveaway is, if you look, this is redundant design from the other monkey. You know, I mean, it's literally a placeholder that was dropped in because, geez, we can't put the tiger out there. So it's kind of, you know, but again, it's anybody who works in theme park design will tell you that. There are things you put on the table that you have to take off, or it's like, well, I don't think people enjoy having steel spikes burrowed into their foreheads. But that was the climax of the ride! Come
what?
On!
What?
Come on!
That's good. What's up with Collie River Rapids? I mean, it doesn't do well in the winter, right? But any plans to change it? Any plans to...
Again, this is Pottery Barn. All right, they have... This attraction is dropped in here. It's the way it's situated to... The animal enclosure areas, they don't, you know, they can't shut it down. You know, in fact, what's going to be kind of interesting, and again, we'll get to Pandora eventually, but, you know, this is a park that you can't change easily. You can't, you know, finesse.
Right.
You know, when you think of all of the back of the house issue, you know, it's just weird. You know, you have animal barns and safe places for cast members to move back and forth between the animal barns.
Right.
You know, the ride... The expansion areas are basically all to the front, and you know, and once you pour that much steel and concrete into, you know, making something like a raft ride,
yeah, you're not gonna move it 16 feet to the left.
No. And that's where we are now. You know, if anything, right now, the future plans for Animal Kingdom are fixated on the front of the park, mostly because, again, that as all the animals in the back go sleepy by, you can keep the tourists in the front.
Ah, so stuff up towards the entrance.
Yes.
Another thing I really like about the Animal Kingdom, they serve beer. Which, not that I drink the beer, but it's just the idea that you can get a drink if you wanted to.
Well, you know, again, you got to make this adult-friendly, if you can.
Yeah. So we're walking up on the Maharaja Jungle Trek right now, which actually, I like both of the jungle treks, and it's one of those things that I'll go on almost every time I'm in the park if I've got nothing to do, because it's not a ride, but the environment that they've created there is so good that it's entertaining to walk through just for the atmosphere itself.
Oh, no, absolutely. And coupled with the fact that you are, in fact, looking at real animals doing as realistic behaviors as animals can do.
In a zoo, right?
In a zoo. You know, I mean, on that level, Disney's Animal Kingdom works. This or Pengani Falls, I mean, you know, but at the same time, it's just when you see that you have to create this space where thousands of people can move through the
right.
space successfully, and it has to be ADA accessible, and everybody has to have a viewpoint, and you also have to have visual language that compels you to move forward, so you
right.
don't spend all day with your face pressed up against a tiger cage. You know, it's this park is doesn't really get the credit sometimes that it's due because of the design, how successful it is. You know, the Disney fan community tends to focus on, you know, where's the next ride?
Yeah.
So.
No, but I mean, for what it does, I mean, I think some of it we'll talk about when we get to the character trails too around Discovery Island. Some of it's absolutely fantastic.
Absolutely.
And it's things that you won't find in any other theme park and Disney theme park. And by that I mean, even when the park is completely full, like we were here during New Year's, there are times when there will be literally no other people on certain part of the animal trails.
But at the same time, now look at the area we are now. We're up by the entrance of Maharaja. People aren't moving with the same speed and urgency that you'll catch at any other theme park.
No. This is, they're not doing the Main Street March, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's almost a hesitancy because it's like the visual language is kind of confusing. It's like, where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to do?
Well, it's definitely slower too. I mean, the fact that you've got trees, you've got so much nature, you've got water, here they've actually got a little bit more retail. You've got a couple of retail stands, you've got a couple of drink carts, you've got some beer, you've got a water fountain, a play water fountain coming up. There are small things to look at, as well as the visual design is different. The other thing, too, is you can't actually see where you're going. I mean, you and I are standing essentially in the middle of the path.
Yep.
We can't see the water from here because we're so far back there.
Absolutely. And, yeah. But at the same time, if you, again, not to dwell on the paving treatment, but, you know, it's always this classic case of the Imagineers build a park and then Ops has to figure
out
how
to run it. Exactly.
And Ops really doesn't care for theme pavement because, A, it's hard to maintain, B, people in wheelchairs have tough times.
You can't push carts on it. You can't get merch around.
That's exactly.
And have you ever tried running on this, by the way?
No.
So we've got to. So it's actually pretty tricky to run on. But one of the interesting stories we have is, we can walk.
Okay.
One of the interesting stories we have is when we were doing data collection for the Animal Kingdom, we had researchers who would do nothing but walk around the park all day.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, what we learned after time is invariably, the people who worked at the Animal Kingdom on a Monday had to have Tuesday off. Because the uneven pavement wreaked such havoc with your knees and ankles and feet over the period of 12 hours that you're in the park, that it was so much more painful than walking through Epcot with its flat pavement or the Magic Kingdom, even with its elevated curbs. It was so much more work to do this. I mean, think about how you're balancing yourself as you're going through this uneven pavement. I mean, imagine doing that, literally doing nothing but walking 20, 25 miles on this. It was so much more work for the data collectors that we had to give them the next day off to recover.
Wow.
Yeah.
But again, this is, authenticity comes at a price. Again, that's one of the reasons why this park is so expensive to maintain. And so expensive when you're looking to put new things in, because it's just sort of like...
It's like why distressed jeans cost so much money. It's like, what?
There we go.
But right. These are $40 jeans, but when you distress them, they're $120, because that takes work. All right, we're coming up, we're bearing to the right here. We're leaving the Kali River Rapids area of Asia, and we're walking up towards the Yak and Yeti Market, the quick service. Have you eaten at the quick service?
We've done the restaurant here, but not the quick service.
Oh, the quick service. So the interesting thing about the quick service is really just okay. There's, I think they've got, what, like half a dozen different menu items on it. The one thing that we've learned from this is that the only thing that works really is the honey chicken, because everything else essentially is sitting under heat lamps. And Chinese food doesn't sit well under heat lamps. The only thing that works really is the honey chicken because it's crispy, and it doesn't quite get as crusty as this. And then we're coming up on the Yak and Yeti sit down, which I really like actually. So it's a 2-story,
yep.
Which is sort of rare for Disney restaurants. There aren't that many of them compared to the 1-stories. It's got lovely theming. It's got great visuals too, actually, from an entrance perspective. Yep. It's very good. Now this is interesting though. This is the thing that you had mentioned this in Tomorrowland. Mm-hmm. If you're walking from Discovery Island and you make a left onto, you make a right onto Asia, and you're walking towards Everest, the entrance to Yak and Yeti is almost at a 270-degree angle from your field of vision. If you're walking straight ahead, like in the morning, you're coming from the bridge, you're walking towards Everest. Unless you're really looking for that Yak and Yeti sign, you're not going to see it. It's exactly the same problem that you mentioned in Monsters Laugh Floor in Tomorrowland.
Yeah, and as I understand it, given the amount of, you know, the grumbling from the people at Yak and Yeti, they are paying for that. That, you know, they don't get the sort of foot traffic.
They don't get the sort of the spontaneous diner experience.
But at the same time, are you going to tear out this wonderful, this pseudo-authentic heap of a statue and the tree with the prayer cloths? And,
to put in a neon sign that says, eat here.
I mean, this is an issue that continually bites this park in the ass.
But they could have done a little bit. The design a little bit differently. I'm not saying that it's an either or. There could have been a compromise in the middle.
But,
I think.
You know, the weird thing is, and now that we live in this age of computer modeling and all that, it's to a lesser extent. You know, they can actually visit the sites of things.
Yeah.
But it's, Disney's only been doing this since 1955.
It's only 50 years. I mean,
it's like at some point it's like, maybe we shouldn't position it there.
But you think they would have learned after Tomorrowland, but I kind of get how something like that could be missed. That's something where you're under a certain amount of time constraint, under a certain amount of budget constraint, and then you need to get it in. I can kind of see that. It just, to me, it's like anybody who's been to Tomorrowland could have seen that might have been a problem, and it's a wasted opportunity. By the way, we're passing Flights of Wonder.
Yeah.
It's an entertaining show, and I'm surprised it's actually lasted this long given the. I'm surprised actually it's lasted this long in its current form. They haven't changed it.
There was, in fact, it's kind of interesting given that while we're here, they're actually doing playtesting for the Wilderness Explorer idea.
Oh, that's right. It's the Kim Possible World Showcase Adventure, but for Animal Kingdom.
Well, they had, and of course that's kicking off of the Russell character from Up, but they had actually taken the giant bird, Kevin.
Yep.
From, and they were going to have Kevin and Doug actually heavily featured in a redo of the bird show here, and for some reason that's off the table right now, which is kind of intriguing that here they are doing the Explorer Kevin stuff. But again, it's Disney; they may circle around to this idea yet again.
Yeah, I mean, ideas, good ideas never die, right? They just sit on a shelf until the next generation comes in and says, "This is brilliant."
And I'm putting my name on it and pretending I invented
it. I'm calling it mine.
There we go.
So we're walking up. Let's walk up to the right here. This is one of the things I like. We're on the walkway between Asia and Africa. And one of the great things about the Animal Kingdom is the fact that you've got these alternate paths to go places. In this instance, there's the main walkway closer to the water, which literally every single person we can see is on. Now now Jim and I are literally walking by ourselves on this path. We're coming up on the little gazebo area that used to be a smoking area. And the funny thing is, again, there's probably, 20,000 people in this... 20,000 people in the park today, 15,000 people. There's literally not another person on the path that we're on right now. It's completely shaded. It's a lot cooler than the main path.
Absolutely.
We've got running water. It's a beautiful scene, and we're the only ones on it. Jim, if this was nighttime, it'd be more romantic.
Oh, man.
I love the running water. Oh, look, a duck. It looks so real. Oh, a family of them. And they were sleeping. So sorry about that. As you were. The waterfall here is a great effect as well. It's got audio, mm-hmm. It's got visual, and if you notice, you can smell sort of the oxidation of the water there, right? And it's really good. And the lighting too fits in really well.
No,
although I think they actually reused these lamps at the Wilderness Lodge, But it works. It works in the Animal Kingdom, just like the Adventureland background music works in Dinoland.
It's so startling. Again, Rhodey insisted on these sorts of things. Of course, now we see why we're the only ones on this path.
Oh, there's a character, a small character green. Yeah, but again, people can get around it and they just don't. This is a character from...
It's Turk from Tarzan. Also my prom date.
Nice.
Nice to hear Steve. She finally found some career that made use of her back here.
That's good for her. I always wondered what happened.
So.
Yeah. I thought that's what Facebook was for, but okay. So we're coming up on Africa now. We're leaving the path. We're coming into Africa. We've got the Musaki drums up on the left where you can channel your inner Tito Puente. That's it. That's the obligatory Tito Puente joke for the podcast right there. And then we've got a small dining area in the back. I've actually never sat there.
Well, there are so many great nooks and crannies to Hammurabi Village, but again, our problem is that people who come into this have come out of Adventureland at the Magic Kingdom, and initially are kind of thrown because it has the authentic chaos of, you know, an African village that you know, the weird little signs that you're supposed to notice about, you know, internet service.
Right.
You know.
And the Mombasa marketplace, the hotel signage, right?
So, let's see.
So, we're coming up on Tusker House, which is going to be a character meal again. So, it was and then it wasn't. By the way, I think Tusker House is underrated. This is one of the areas where the unofficial guide dining reviewer and I continually disagree. It used to be about LaSalle, now it's about Tusker House. I think this is, so it gets 1.5 stars in the unofficial guide. I think it's a 2.5 star establishment.
Now, you do know about Joe signing this place, right?
No. He signed it? Oh, so Joe Rhodey apparently put his signature somewhere on the... Joe Rhodey Masks and Beads. That's funny. So it's J-O-R-O-D-I Masks and Beads. That's funny, Joe Rhodey. Is that his real phone number?
I guess probably, we could find
probably not. But if only there's a way we could call him while we're in the park.
Hey, what's the deal with this advertising?
So it's funny when I did... yeah. So it's funny. I see him like once every 2 years.
Yep.
And they always open up with the same line. Hi, I'm Len Testa from the Unofficial Guide. Mm-hmm. Eventually he'll figure it out. But, you know, in fact, they only see him once every 2 years. Probably not. And probably see so many people, too. Mm-hmm. All right, so we're coming up. We're up on, Africa right now. We've got to our left the Kilimanjaro Safari's entrance. To our right is the Panjani Forest and the Wildlife Express train area. And in the middle, this is actually a fairly thriving marketplace. You've got face painting. You've got... it says film, but it's really bracelets and jewelry and stuff. Oh, there's film. And then you've got fresh fruits, water, and other things. And you've got... it looks like they're doing some sort of filming today. Ah, interesting.
But
What's going on with Kilimanjaro Safari?
Again, we're in a weird space where we have spent... The Disney spending company has spent so much money on infrastructure, on ride vehicles, on animal enclosures. They are trying... You know, after, you know, everyone knows all of the stories associated with Kilimanjaro. You know, the big red, little red, how that dropped, the poacher angle. Now...
That was a little strident after the 20th or 30th time you've heard it.
Well, that is the other issue, that they have found that by shoehorning the story elements, or, you know, bookending the ride, if you will, it actually hurt rewritability, that people just wanted to go and see the animals.
Yeah, you don't actually need a story. You just let the animals be.
But they are trying now to, you know, that they're reworking the lax sequence of the ride. And in fact, you know, that's the other thing about, well, what do we do now? Because we created this artificial river that we run up, but we've created this space where we have, you know, this is the climax of our ride, but we have poured so much concrete, so much steel in the ground.
Yeah.
And again, we have animal enclosures on either side of us. How do we put a new climax in this attraction? And they're on their fifth iteration at this point. They're trying to figure out, you know, that they've got a witch doctor shaman storyline that
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, the whole notion of you're going out into, you know, to see the animals, and you introduce this character at the beginning and you introduce to him at the end. And, you know, did you learn anything? it'll be interesting to see if they can actually do it. Because, again, it's so often with this park, they are handcuffed because, you know, just you can't. It's like, Mr. Lion, if you could just sit here for about 3 days while we tear down your building and put in a new effect, would you be okay with that? And, oh, stop biting my leg. You know,
will you go move the lion and keep him company for a week while we completely transform this experience?
It's not going to work.
That's not going to happen.
You know, so that's why, again, they're concentrating on, well, what can we do to the front of the park? And once people are coming and staying down there, you can do things like, you know, but this is the other reality. If you take down Kilimanjaro for 6 months to a year to do work on it, to retool it, you still have hundreds of animals out there that have to be fed, that have to be cared for.
I was going to say fed and clothed, but I think your direct the description is better.
And more to the point, that when you shut the attraction down, you literally, once you bring it back up, they have to spend like a week to 10 days just running empty vehicles through.
To get the animals used to it again.
Yeah, because otherwise it's like, well, what the hell, a truck? You know, I mean, it just, there are, you know, operational issues with this park that none of the other parks deal with.
Yeah. And it's the live animals. It's the
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and it's both the draw of this park and the unfortunate to put this, the monkey on its back.
The monkey on its back. So. That's clever. So. Clever. All right. What about the Panjani Forest Exploration Trail? Anything going on? Same thing.
They are they're looking to create more of a. In fact, for a time, they were looking to try to push the Wilderness Explorer experience down into that area. They believe it's both.
The whole experience into that one area.
Well, the notion of so many people walk by Pangani without actually going down into it, and that's part of the frustration with ops for this park is that you can't see what's down there,
right.
And you can put up all sorts of signs, but people just got off of a vehicle. In fact, the way this was originally built. You were supposed to, Pangani Forest, being able to walk the trail there, that was your reward for having saved the baby elephant?
Was to walk through the forest?
That's it, exactly. It's like, you have been so good. We are sending you down into the forest. Nobody gets to do this. And, you know, it was a perk. But what they found for a lot of people is like, thank you, I don't want the perk.
Yeah, no, that's good. We have to get on the next
park.
Ride.
You know, so.
So some spontaneous drumming is just broken out in Africa, as it is wont to do. I know every time I'm on the continent, I can't walk two blocks without a band breaking out a song here. All right, so we're walking back. By the way, we're passing the Dawa Bar, which normally I would say let's stop off at the Dawa Bar for a drink, but too noisy right now. So we're walking back over the bridge to Discovery Island. To our left is the silhouette of Everest. To our right is a bend in the river. Still looks pretty nice.
This was, again, Discovery River. This, for example...
Yeah, you can see the boat landing to the left, yeah.
Right there. But this was the area you actually came through that had... there's supposedly volcanic steam coming up out of the ground, and so you get a fountain effect.
Oh, neat.
But, it's like, what am I looking at? And then there was nothing. There was nothing to look at.
Steam!
And that was it.
Woo! Smile! So we're over... we just left Asia... we just left Africa. We're going to make a left. We're walking along the character trails. Again, this is part of my favorite part of the park here, because no one ever goes here except for this one kid who is apparently lost. Watch out for the crocodiles, kid. storks, crocodiles, whatever, it's all the same. But there's nobody here. It's beautiful. This is another example where the park's fairly crowded today. There are people on the main walkways, but we're on a path, and now there's two other people, and that's it. And you get to see lots of animals. So we've got storks here. We've got, I think coming up, we've got parrots, right?
Yep. But you're right.
You hear the background music. It's quiet. Oh, we've got the African crested porcupine is out. As I like to say everywhere in the animal kingdom, them's good eating. It looks like he's wearing a lampshade, but if Martha Stewart was angry and took her knitting needles and turned it into a lampshade, that's what the porcupine is essentially wearing. And he goes back into his cave, much like Martha Stewart does. Is it slither the word I'm looking for there, Jim? I'm not entirely certain.
On behalf of Martha Stewart's attorneys, I thank you.
For the business, right? Oh, so there's no parrots out today. I don't see the parrots out.
One lurking to the back.
Oh, there is a... Oh, wait, where? Small parrot. small parrot hiding. Apparently knew we were coming and didn't want the publicity. Also, so we're coming up on the display of the Nene goose and the giant Galapagos turtle, as opposed to the minor Galapagos turtle. And all I really see here is a duck.
So,
apparently the tortoise is union.
They have a great attorney. No, I...
But again,
I'm sorry.
There's no one here.
We're overlooking... The giant rock is actually the tortoise.
Oh, the giant rock is the tortoise.
There we go.
Again, I blame my ophthalmologist.
Okay, so...
That is a huge tortoise.
You know, if all had gone according to plan, we would not only be able to enjoy the view down here, we've been able to enjoy the view up there.
Really? In the Tree of Life?
The plan initially was that there were viewing platforms. I mean, literally, if you look at the structure, the whole oil rig thing that they built here, this could have easily supported sort of the optimum photo spot for this park. And the idea was that they're going to have... one iteration was a spectacular restaurant. Another one was just...
Really? In the Tree of Life?
Yes. And,
ooh.
You know, and the other iteration was just literally a viewing platform where you could go up and take great photos. But again, is it sort of the theme with this park? As more got spent on back of the house, there was less for, you know, front of the house.
So again, there's another walkway here, and this is actually one of my favorite parts of this little trail. There's a small walkway, but you have to notice that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're walking towards the Tree of Life, it's on your left. And again, everyone walks by it because it's literally the path can't be 5 feet wide, but it leads you to a small little bench area where you can look across. By the way, the vultures are circling, Jim. You can look across.
I'm not dead yet.
You can look across to the to Asia over where the bathrooms are, sort of. Just to the left of Flights of Wonder, but you've got two waterfalls, one immediately to your left and one in front of you. You've got nothing but scenery. You've got the birds flying in the sky. It's an amazing, relaxing place. You've got a little bit of background music, but it's not overwhelming. It's just very tranquil, very peaceful, and in the middle of a Disney theme park. You just never get this.
No.
You could come here and nap.
Absolutely, absolutely. On the other hand, looking at the way the birds are circling...
Yeah, there's got to be literally 100 hawks or buzzards.
I hope Big Red is okay.
Big Red, what? You mean the poachers are back, Jim? Actually, they're over... it looks like they're over Everest right now.
Oh, dear.
it was better than being over Dinoland, I guess.
Speaking of which, that's actually the... one of my favorite phases of when they test attractions...
Yep.
Before they actually hand them off to ops, what they'll do is they'll have the ride track in. They have what they refer to in the attraction as the envelope of protection.
Right.
As in, if you're reaching out of the car and, you know, the 6 foot tall man with, you know, the length of his arm, he shouldn't be able to touch the wall.
Right.
So what they do to test this theory is they jam a 2x4 in the front of the car.
Do they really?
Seriously. And they then send it out, and it's at the angle as if a 6 foot tall man with an impressive reach. And then they stand in the station and wait.
And they see if the entire 2x4 comes
back? Yes,
down.
And often when it comes back with the shredded 2x4, it's like, uh-oh.
Oh, huh, missed that.
And now you have to walk the ride track and look for the impact point. So I just remember being here for Everest, you know, one day, and just literally sitting, watching a 2x4 take endless rides through the attraction. So...
Again, we're walking. We just walked past the back of the Tree of Life, and again, an amazing amount of waterfall. You also get to see. This is probably the place where you get the closest view of all of the details. So in the back, we see I see a lion, I see a crab, a seal, Waldo, snail, mongoose. It's amazing. It's a lot of... But again, unless you're coming out of the exit of Tough to Be a Bug, you really don't ever get to see this part. And generally, everybody, when they exit Tough to Be a Bug, everyone goes right.
Yep.
No one goes left, which is why the first half of the trail that we were on is so uncrowded.
But this happens over and over again in this park because of you know, again, Rohde deliberately had designed this environment that
allowed... It's ambiguous. That's the thing. It's an ambiguous environment. That confuses the hell out of people.
Yeah. And
the other thing, too, by the way, you notice it's remarkably shaded back there.
Yep. Yeah. No, and more to the point, it's one of the genuinely cool parts of the park, you know, which...
Yeah. The water, the misting of the waterfall. Yep. Okay, so we're exiting Tough to Be a Bug. We're back on Discover Island, going past a Beastly Bazaar.
Yeah. Which kind of segues into talking about a part of this park that was announced. In fact, you walk in, you know, there on the ticket booth is your dragon. You know, Beastly Kingdom that never got built here.
Beastly Kingdom. That's right. There's we're walking up towards Camp Mini Mickey, the soon-to-be formerly Camp Mini Mickey. It's going to go the way of Mickey's Toontown, I believe, but we'll see. But we're walking up towards that, and so we're back on Discover Island, kind of walking back from the Asia Park now.
But yeah, that was, I mean, again, budget-wise, that was going to get pushed out. You know, phase one of the park was open. That was going to be phase two.
Beastly Kingdom was going to be phase two.
As a placeholder, in fact, to give you some idea of what a placeholder it was, that the Imagineers were so busy building the other parts of the park, they couldn't do Camp Mini Mickey. They actually handed it off to Entertainment.
Entertainment built Camp Mini Mickey, not Imagineers?
Yep. I mean, and they forced, you know, they threw together the you know, and again, it's just, when you realize that, you know, for example, the Festival of the Lion King show, that's built, you know, 90% of that is built out of old parade floats from Disneyland.
I thought it was Elton John's closet. Are you sure about your source on this one? Because I'm like 90% confident here, Jim.
That would be the song I Just Can't Wait to Be Queen. So.
No, you've been saving that one. That was good.
Sorry.
I just came up with that. That was great.
All right. So they horseshoe this in. They just, like... You know, the last 6 or 8 months, they come up with, you know, these sort of Adirondack theme. You know, you can meet with the characters, you get the show back there. Nobody anticipated that when they opened, you know...
It's going to be there more than a year, right? Two years, whatever.
More to the point that it would get, you know, when they were surveying people, they'd say, what's your favorite thing in the park? Top three. It made the top three.
Really?
Yeah. And now it's like, well, you can't close it. You have a park that has too few attractions.
Yeah, really, there's what? Legitimately, there's like a dozen things here.
No.
Yeah, whereas Magic Kingdom, you're looking at, you know, 50, 60.
And, you know, when you talk with the Imagineers who worked on Beastly Kingdom, I had lunch once with Maggie Parr, mm-hmm. who worked on the Quest for the Unicorn attraction there.
Yep.
And it's a heartbreaker. I mean, they were going to do things in there where literally what was going to move you through the maze was that they were going to do this great audio effect where you'd hear the Minotaur just behind you, so if you
dallied,
that's right. It's like, oh, okay, gotta move.
Oh, look at the time, gotta go.
You know,
let's see what's around this next bend.
But they opened up, you know, they eventually, when you got to the center of the, you know, of the maze, there was this beautiful grotto where, you know, sunlight streaming in among flowers. There on this island in the middle of the grotto was the unicorn that would turn and acknowledge you, and you know, just it was this. You know, it's an amazing, beautiful moment. But, you know, conversely, it was going to have also this kick-ass inverted roller coaster.
Really?
That, you know, the Dragon's Tower, where, you know, the gimmick of it is you're in the queue, and as you're walking through, there are these bats that... You know,
bats?
Auto-animatronic bats that proceed to... You know, there's a great treasure hoard at the center of this thing, and we would really appreciate your help in getting the treasure. But again, you know, it's... So you're going through, you know, you're riding up to you know, the sort of your launch hill, and the bat said, we may not have mentioned the dragon. And they had designed this amazing dragon that was at the center of the coast that you were constantly going to swoop by, and you're going to have this huge fire effect. But because it was a dragon, it was going to be different than any Disney dragon you've ever seen, because he spent all of his 90% of his time life lying on top of this hoard of treasure. So when he stood up, coins and jewels are pressed into his body. And
right.
But yeah, it was ready to go. It was all there. And in fact, if you remember, you know, doing the Discovery River boat cruise when this park opened, you literally, it was part of the spiel that coming here soon will be Beastly Kingdom. And that was why they actually had the dragon fire effect. In fact, those people who went to the cast member previews There was this, they actually took this prop out. It was much like they took Big Red out. Mm-hmm. That when you went by the Dragon's Cave, there were all of these lances with suits of armor that had been speared through them, draped over the dragon, and melted pieces of, you know, like a helmet sitting on top of a melted pile of iron, you know, to send that there's a drained, dangerous creature in there that has killed people. And it's like, and come back in a couple of years and you can meet him. And that...
It's a great visual, though. You can totally see it.
It was, you know, in fact, if you go out on the web, look around, there's one or two shots from the cast preview disc before they pulled it down.
Oh, that's funny. So we're walking out, just entered Camp Mini Mickey here, or as we're wont to call it, Pandora soon, right? We're passing Pizzafari. And Pizzafari actually is not bad. It's decorated very well, actually.
No, actually, it's
got some great air conditioning back there,
and
too.
And it's huge!
It's huge! Yeah. It is. It's very colorful here. Mm-hmm. Now, they're going to... So this is the thing. This is the area that we think is they're going to...
Well,
will be Pandora.
We were talking earlier about this. They're actually doing the sort of slippy, slidey thing with...
Could be here. Could be there.
Well, it's definitely here. It's definitely at the front of the park in this portion. Because, again, the whole notion is to have an area that guests can go into and stay in as the animal parts of the park set to close for the night.
Right. So there actually aren't any animals in Camp Mini Mickey.
No.
I mean, other than Mickey and Minnie, who are technically animals, but if there are any kids listening, yeah.
Well, 16, 17-year-olds technically are animals.
Yeah, that's true. So we're walking over the bridge now. To get to Camp Mini Mickey, and there's the dragon fountain that you had mentioned, Jim.
But right up there, you can actually see the rock work.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So there's in the middle of the river, by the way, the river is essentially stagnant. It's covered in an entire, it's literally looks like a green carpet of moss. Mm-hmm. You can't see any water because of this green moss that's over it. But yeah, off in the distance, sort of around the corner, there are about half a dozen rock outcroppings where Jim was mentioning they would have put these suits of armor. That would have melted.
You can actually see, you know, the sort of where the lances were stuck in,
yep.
With the, you know, the holes where the lances were stuck, the armor was dragging off of them. It was...
Oh, is that what... Okay, yeah, I thought it was just a detail in the rock. Yeah,
you can't really see it from here, but there's a cave or a little indention.
Yeah.
And your boat would come by, and going up to this moment, a sensor would kick off as you move between these two points, and you'd see the fire, get fire effect... And then you'd pass the sensor further on, and they'd do the fire effect afterwards. But,
oh, neat.
But yeah, it was this is where, just picture here, this would have actually been what we're looking at here, would have been the nice side of the fairy tale world, which is the quest to the unicorn. And then, again, your left and right choice, the theme that Len's been bringing up repeatedly, if you went to the left, that was where... The dark side of the kingdom was. That's where Quest for the Dragon, the villains, and those such hung out. But yeah, it was ready to go. But again, once they opened this park and discovered... In fact, that's where this gets kind of interesting. A piece of Disney history is when they opened Animal Kingdom, they thought for sure that people were going to add another day to the vacation because they're going to stay for the fourth theme park.
Right.
But what actually happened was that people... You know, again, it wasn't like Americans suddenly acquired yet another vacation day. They just decided, okay, I'm going to shave a half day off of Epcot, or I'm not going to go to the studios.
Exactly.
But literally, this park opened, and it cannibalized attendance there. I mean, Kingdom is still, even to this day.
Yeah, you know, 18, 19, 20 million.
Yeah.
And these parks, the studios and the Animal Kingdom were a little less than half, right?
Yeah, that's it exactly. So, you know, didn't wound them at all. But here, you know, it suddenly became, wow, you know, and they actually moved money that they were going to spend on expanding Animal Kingdom to dropping significant new attractions into Epcot and studio. I mean, it's not a coincidence that Rock and Roller Coasters suddenly, you know, it's like, hey, we need something, you know?
We're walking by now. There's there's yet another waterfall. This is the one that's to your right as you're walking in Camp Mini Mickey. It's the one where you see Huey, Louie, and Dewey. In their camping outfits, in the Boy Scout outfits to your right, and Daisy is guiding them. So coming up, we've got Festival of the Lion King show building to our right. We've got some merchandise and some minor counter service food stands straight ahead of us. That's really what it looks like. From the crowd, it looks like a Festival of the Lion King just let out.
Yep. But again, so much of this was. What can we make work in this space? And so, you know, the Pocahontas and her friend show. It's like, okay, you know, how long would it take us to train a corn snake? You know, it's like, okay, we're in.
And 3 months.
This, you know, again, this flew in the last 6 or 8 months of the project.
And the entertainment group did this one.
And the entertainment group did this. And it then became quite a bone of contention because, of course, Imagineering having spent, you know, upwards of $4 million to make this theme park, and now the attraction that was built for 15, you know, the whole area that was built for 15,
right,
is suddenly doing land office business. In regard to this news, the week of this news, or the news of this week, the James Cameron World of Avatar deal, what's interesting is that, again, they're looking to put this really down to the front of the park, to the point where there's evidently already been conversations with the folks at Rainforest Cafe to the effect of, look, this is James Cameron, we're going to give him whatever he wants, and if that means we need to swallow, you know, your restaurant, goodbye.
Yeah, this has been great. It's been fabulous for us, but it's time for you to go.
So, this, you know, we were talking a little bit about this earlier. This announcement came, it surprised a lot of Imagineers. I mean, a lot of Imagineers, as in
coming on a random Tuesday in September.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing you said is you'd alluded to was that it didn't come at D23.
No.
It didn't come on the 40th anniversary, which is, you know, coming up. It came sort of on a random Tuesday in September.
Well, that's another interesting part of this story. That supposedly, again, this is not Disney calling the shots on this, because Disney wanted to do it at D23. In fact, the original Parks and Resorts presentation was a half hour longer. When suddenly, because there had been discussions about, you know, well, we want to take this to Shanghai, we don't want to take this to Paris, we want to take Tokyo. It's like now the lawyers had to go into extra innings, so they couldn't announce at D23.
Oh, because then it's a forward-looking statement. And okay.
There we look. Now, though, Disney's like, okay, we're going to announce it October 1st, we're going to have something special with the birthday, and Fox is no.
Fox
Filmed Entertainment, the studio that made, you know, work with James Cameron to make Avatar. It's like, no, you're going to announce it on Tuesday. And it's like, why are you announcing it on Tuesday?
Tuesday's always a good news day.
Tuesday, they're announcing it on that day because James Murdoch, the head of Fox, you know, the Fox publishing company, Fox Corp, is going to be back appearing in front of a committee at
Parliament.
You know, in fact, they're concerned about the phone hacking thing. And Fox was actually worried that their stock would take a hit that day. So they figured if the James Cameron announcement came out on the same day, it's a wash.
This is all hypothetically speaking, right?
Oh, of course.
No one would ever actually think about this.
I don't know where I would have possibly heard this
locker room gossip. It's almost entirely, certainly untrue.
There we go.
Yeah, that's exactly it. This could never happen in the United States, Jim.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
What? It's screwless rumor. Screwless rumor.
Anyway.
Walk this way?
Sure. But
so we're walking towards Festival of the Lion King now. And, they've got the misters out, which tells you how warm it is. We're coming up on yet another bridge to Festival.
But again, I guess the takeaway here, honestly, the reason you're probably going to see Festival stay is the amount of money they've spent in closing the building and putting in those big-ass air conditioners. So,
Festival of the Lions!
It's a consolation. So literally, this is the only thing here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the character trails are back there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a ton of people actually coming from the character trails right now, but that's about it. And then they're all heading towards Festival of the Lion King. So we're back now, sort of almost as far back as you could go in Camp of Mini Mickey. Where would they start putting the Pandora stuff?
Think Pocahontas toward the entrance, all right?
Okay, so we're actually facing the entrance right now, so we'd be back sort of towards the way we came.
And
so it would actually take up the Rainforest Cafe area.
That's it, exactly. Okay. So
how big in terms of acreage are they looking at for this?
We are talking Cars Land size expansion. I have heard estimates that start at 12, go out to 15.
I heard 12 to 16, something like that, 16 and a half.
Now, mind you, because, you know, the couple of things. That we have been promised the second use, or not promised, suggested loudly the second use of soaring technology. There will be.
Oh, really? So when Matt Hochberg said that this is going to be soaring over Pandora, he was onto something.
Literally, I'm forgetting the name of the Fox producer, John Landau, that is Cameron's longtime producer. It's like, ooh, the flying ray. When do you see the flying ray? So, I mean, they're already...
Whereas Imagineering is saying, yeah, you know, really in the conceptual stage right now. We haven't really got anything. And Landau's like, oh, it'll be soaring.
Yeah. So, the other thing is that they want to do... And what they showed the film a lot to Imagineers. They showed the film to...
Imagine what that was like. Hey, guess what you're doing today for 12 hours.
Yeah. And the takeaway was, like, people want to go to the forests of Pandora, but... Yeah. But here's the thing.
People like the environment.
Yes, but watch the movie again. Where are the sidewalks in Pandora? All right?
Where's the urban planning? I mean, yes, they know about ecology. Yes, they know about conservation.
But when
urban planning, really, not a damn thing.
When you have to move a couple of thousand people through an hour, an environment like this, and face it, when this opens, this is going to be hot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and everybody wants to touch a plant to make the fiber optics move, or everybody wants to touch the bug and make it fly.
Right.
Or... This is a lot of hands-on stuff. This is a lot of theoretical.
It's essentially what they did with Harry Potter, right? Where it's so immersive that you constrain the number of people. Because remember when Harry Potter opened, there were 9-hour lines.
But here's the problem: that Harry Potter works daytime, nighttime, whatever.
Yeah.
Pandora, because you have to sell the luminescent idea, it means enclosed.
Enclosed. They're gonna enclose the whole thing. A giant dome over the animal kingdom.
See, well, that's actually...
They could put a commentary about global warming in there somewhere, and that would be fine.
Well, the interesting thing is that there's at least one prototype of the building that literally is the Pandora. I mean, the idea of they're going to do a projection effect of the gas moving across the building. So you'll get that sort of Jupiter cloud effect. Because, again, they want you to... When you arrive from the parking lot, you're going to go... Pandora. And face it, it's not like they can do another tree.
Yeah, no, get another tree. No.
You know, all right.
That's what I was thinking, actually. How are they going to fit two trees in here? But they're not going to do a tree.
No. Okay, right. So it's a luminescent, bioluminescent forest that reacts to you, that you can walk through, coupled with a couple of smaller attractions. They're still trying to wrap their head around about how do you do the 9-foot-tall naked blue characters.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be a little problematic.
The casting for that is going to be incredible. I just want to watch the character procession that comes in for that.
Well, weren't you saying that this is going to be the second home for models from Costa Rica?
So apparently, you need 9-foot-tall skinny people, right?
To
fit in the costumes. So it's going to be the old folks home for Brazilian models, which is good, though, because they've already got the connection to Brazil here. So that's going to work out well.
Go.
Yeah.
But no, it's definitely, you know, we are so far out from them showing us any art or being,
it's all conceptual at this point.
But that, the idea is that this is going to be the drive. You're going to come into the parking lot and much the way you can see Everest and go, ooh, I want to go there, you're going to see Pandora. But again, with the understanding it's to the front of the park, it can stay open later than all of the other stuff, and it will then... allow this park to creep its operating hours out from a 5 to 6 close to
7 to 8.
You know, and it's sort of the same thing that when they were having the conversations about bringing World of Color here, the whole notion of dropping that in the lagoon in front of Asia, in front of Everest,
right?
Which, you know, it was a really great idea until they actually talked to people at Disneyland and talked about, no, we use purified water, we clean, and
you're not gonna green water.
So, you know, that show system is in play between Disney Hollywood Studios and Epcot. It'll be interesting to see where it lands. So,
I don't see it in Epcot. I see it in the studios, but we'll see. Yeah, actually, you can go in the studios on the run to Echo Lake.
Well, they're looking at it. This is kind of a sad comment on the way Disney thinks now. It's like, wow, we could redo Fantasmic and get rid of the cast members. You know, I mean, it's...
Wait, I thought giant corporations were job creators, Jim. Wait, I don't understand.
Well, you know, they'll need people to point, sit down there.
Oh, okay, never mind. We're back to even then. All right.
There we go.
All right. It's been fantastic. All right, well, why don't we walk out to the park? We'll do any sort of a last wrap-up. When do you think we'll start to see concept art and ideas from Pinterest. Now, the interesting thing is this, right? So you and I have both worked in large corporations before. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's ever done a multi-year budget for a large corporation will tell you, generally speaking, everyone knows what's going to happen in 6 months with like 90% probability. You start talking about a year out, things get to be more, I wouldn't say hypothetical, I would say more aspirational, right? Right? And by the time you look at 2 years out, much less certainly. The stuff that's 3, 4, and 5 years out are essentially goals that we'd like to achieve, but we have neither the time nor the money to commit to them right now. So the thing that I'm interested in, and you know, from Pandora is, construction's not going to start for another year and a half. We're not going to see anything until 2015. Pretty much everything, literally every single thing, other than maybe James Cameron's name and the color of the people, I think are in play at this point.
Very much so. And in fact, what's kind of interesting is, given, again, that it's not like they have to go out and do the survey work. They've done the survey work.
That's true, yeah. They kind of know where everything is in the park, right?
You know, I mean, all they need to do is go back to the Beastly Kingdom schematics and go, okay, sewer lines here, electrical there. You know, there's an infrastructure or, you know, places where they can begin to tie into existing infrastructure.
I was going to say, they kind of stubbed everything out is what you're saying.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's just sort of like, okay, what's feasible?
Given the amount of money that we have, what can we do?
In fact, let me make a suggestion.
That's what it's going to come down to.
To West Coast listeners of this, pay very close attention to Craigslist. Disney has been doing, in fact, they've actually just created a website called Disney Playtest, where they actually recruit people to come in and test early concepts for attractions. And I guarantee you, given how blue sky,
they're going to be running that just through there. They typically do that in Glendale?
Yeah, they'll bring you in. In fact, I can't tell you the number of times I heard from disappointed mothers about, you know, they took their daughter to the Cinderella playtest for the meet and greet thing for here.
Yeah.
They took their daughter to do the Sleeping Beauty version. It's like, what do you mean they're not building it? It was wonderful.
Okay. Wonderful idea. It was too expensive. I mean, that's life at a giant corporation, though. I kind of see how that happens.
So,
Craigslist in Glendale and Burbank?
Yep.
All right, look out for that playtest. If anybody gets anything on that, please contact Jim or I. Would love to know what sort of ideas they've run through you, run past you guys on that. That'll be true. All right, Jim. So this has been a great walkthrough of the Animal Kingdom. We're gonna have to do this again in 6 months or so when we actually know a little bit more about Pandora, and we'll see what's changed, and we'll do an update. But thanks very much for coming out. Thanks very much, everybody, for listening. I hope this was fun. Jim, I think what's next? We're going to do Epcot. That'll be fun. We'll have a lovely weekend.
And then fall down,
exactly. Hopefully, Disney tells us, by the way, again, this is the end of September. It's like 92 degrees here. Disney tells us the temperature is supposed to drop 25 degrees over the next 24 hours. We'll see what happens there. Anyway, guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next show.
Take care.
Stupid Judy, stupid energy.
This has been a production of Mouse World Radio.